Classical music returns to Valley Free Radio. Tune in to Andy Musique Wednesday mornings at 6 a.m. for an hour of beautiful music to start your day, hosted by Lucy and Larry.
The Forbes Library staff would like to remind you of the incredible resource that you have in your local public library. We have tens of thousands of books for you to check out, music CDs, movies, newspapers from around the region, the state, and the country. We have a wide variety of magazines and free computer and internet access every day. We also have our incredible reference services there to help you answer particularly vexing problems. All of this is free, locally available at 20 West Street in Northampton. So come by and check us out in person or at www.forbeslibrary.org or call 587-1011 for more information.
Off the Record every Sunday from 7 to 8 p.m.
for some of the craziest comedy music from past and present,
hosted by DJ Darren.
I'm Rachel Maddow with the Pioneer Valley Planning Commission and the Franklin Regional Council of Governments for Valley Free Radio. Reminding you that legally, bicycles are vehicles, and bicyclists have the same rights and responsibilities and should observe the same rules as motorists. For more information on bicycle rights and safety, go to www.massbike.org.
Hi, I'm Ruthie, and I have a recorder. Tune in Wednesdays from 4 to 5 to Out There. We'll meet people and plants around the streets and paths of Northampton, and we'll think about ways we can share the world here on Valley Free Radio or archived online at weatherbeer.com/out there. Get out if you can, but if you can't get out, tune in.
We don't care if they laugh at us. Let them take the bus and need a sickle for us. They can have the Cadillac and T-1-2, but give me my rocket bicycle for two.
So, thanks for tuning in today. It's Wednesday, August... What is it? This show was originally recorded on August 17th, 2016. And I have a live guest in the studio today, Susan Stinson.
Hi.
Thanks for coming in today, Susan. So most of the show will be talking with Susan. I also have a little clip from a boy I saw met on the rail trail in East Hampton yesterday who was selling lemonade. So Susan is, she lives in Northampton. She's a novelist, editor, and writing coach, author of Spider in a Tree and Fat Girl Dances with Rocks and a couple other books. But before we get to that, I'm just going to play this, I'll play the interview with this boy that I met yesterday evening when I was biking in East Hampton.
I thought that must be great.
Okay.
25 cents a cup's pretty cheap. That's good.
So I was riding down the bike path, and there's a lemonade stand, 25 cents a cup. Can you introduce yourself?
I'm Osh Goldstein Day, and I'm usually open on Saturdays and Sundays, but sometimes I usually try to make things up for days I'm not there, and so I do any other day of the week, and I usually try to do it around 5:30. So it's past the rush hour and gives people time to, get home and settle and then have the idea, I think I'm going to go on the bike path for a walk. And then they see a lemonade stand and they're like, oh, perfect timing.
Nice.
But some people forget to bring their wallets, but it's okay. And I might sell hot chocolate in the winter.
Nice. Do you sell on credit if people have forgotten their wallet?
No, because I don't have that technology.
Is this your number one fan?
Definitely.
He's my dad. Yep.
Yeah. Anything else you want to say about how great your product is or your service or?
Well, it's all fresh and real lemonade, not the powder.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Like lemon juice, you squeeze it yourself?
Yeah. My mom squeezes it. It's actually very easy to make.
Uh-huh.
And it usually takes me about an hour to sell out. And not that I don't get a lot of customers, it's just that I have like a 2 gallon, well, not a 2 gallon, like a half gallon container, and so I have a lot of stuff and don't sell out of it that quickly.
Mm-hmm. So when you're waiting for customers, what do you do?
I usually have a bigger book out and I read. I'm just waiting for a book right now.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm reading little books.
Mm-hmm.
And if I finish the books, I sometimes like sleep while I wait for customers to come by.
Great. Anything else you want to add?
That it's very cheap.
It is. 25 cents a cup. Very cheap. Thank you. All right. I will recommend that lemonade stand in East Hampton. It's between, it's on the other side of East Hampton when you're headed to the Southampton line. And I had some after I interviewed him, and it was tasty. And speaking of books, Susan, I thought you would appreciate that little interview of the boys' love for books.
I loved it. And I also really loved the sound of the lemonade pouring. Mm. That sounded really appealing.
Yeah, I had an empty water bottle, so it was perfect timing. I needed a drink and didn't really want a plastic cup, and I had my bottle, so yeah. So, again, to introduce Susan, she's an author and editor, writing coach, etc. So today's interview, I'm going to focus on the book, her first novel, Fat Girl Dances with Rocks, because that's the only one I've read, and I read it this summer and enjoyed it. But, like Susan, I knew you from around town as a cyclist. I'd see you
on the bike path.
Yeah, on the bike path or on the streets.
Like in the winter. We were the only winter. Ones out there, right?
Yeah. Yeah, for years I've seen you riding around town on your trike, and I would just be thinking, that woman is rocking it. Like, literally. which, when I saw you at the farmer's market the other day, you showed me you had an electric assist trike now.
That's new. Right. I had to get a heavier frame because my frames were breaking. They weren't rated for my weight. You know, it's really hard to find a trike that's designed for somebody who's big like I am. And so I got it's called a Hilltopper. It's a kit that you could just add to any bike, and I love it so much. It really helps because this trike is heavier than my past trikes. It was really hard to pedal, especially because I have arthritis in my knees, which is one of the reasons I'm on the trike so much. That and the fact that I don't have a car. And between the trike and the e-bike piece of it now, I just feel so free. It's so fantastic.
And will the electronics parts, I mean, how will they hold up in the winter or rain? Or have you been through a winter yet?
I have. Yeah. I've had one for 2 years. It was a present when my last novel came out, which was so sweet. They installed it for me while I was on the book tour. So then it was like so exciting to come back to. And that was in October. So then I was heading into winter. I've got the battery with me. I could show you if you wanted. But the motor is in a sealed hub on the wheel. And it's fine. And the battery is a little more vulnerable, but they have it very well insulated, and then it's covered in this bag. And, you know, I think the battery, like I've had to replace the battery, but I use it all winter and I haven't had a problem.
Well, you got it. Oh, you said you've had it 2 years?
Yeah, 2 years.
Okay. How long did you have the battery before you had to replace it?
Well, so it's pretty strange, actually. And now that I think of it, it's been 3 years. So the first battery I got is still running. It's still going. But a year ago, I decided to get another battery just because I'm so dependent on the trike, and I knew that I was probably pushing the life of the battery, and I could tell that it was losing scope. It wouldn't go twice as far. It's rated for 20 miles, but it doesn't really take me and my trike that far. If you didn't pedal without it, right?
Yeah. You mean if you just push, like, yeah, there's like a throttle, right, and then there's like an assist, right?
Well, no, there's a push button on the handle, and so I don't think it's I don't know. Is it a throttle? I guess if that was a go-kart, you might call that a throttle. I don't know. But that's what gives you the juice. So that's okay. The only thing that gives you the juice. But you can also pedal. Yeah. So you can pedal while you're doing that, and you can also just pedal without it.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So, the newest battery is just stopped working, and maybe rain-related, you know? So it only lasted a year. Mm-hmm. But the first one lasted 3 years. It's still going.
Cool. Were there any difficulties in finding a trike to suit your needs?
Yeah. You know, my partner helped me a lot with that. She's a cyclist herself, and she did a lot of research. So she's the one who actually found it. And you know, they sell them locally, but those trikes turned out. I mean, if someone was doing a starter, you know, you could look around and find one around here, and that probably would be the best thing to do because they're a little bit cheaper, you know? But yeah, it was a little bit hard to find one. Even the one I have now is not rated for my weight, which is a little counterproductive if you want people to be active, right?
Yeah.
You know? But this one, we got a recommendation from a bike shop. They said they thought that this one was particularly sturdily built. So, and it is, it's holding up well, although my bike got stolen last year.
Your trike.
My trike did. Oh, yeah.
Wait, how does someone steal something like this?
It was so ridiculous. The reason was I was going away to a writer's conference, and I rode my trike to the Peter Pan bus station, and I left it locked. But it was gone when I got home. So I got home like at 11. It was one night, but I left it.
Just overnight, one night.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yep. And it was gone when I got off the bus at 11 o'clock the next night. So so that was really terrible. But I'll tell you, you know, I got home, I called the police, and then it was the Green River Festival the next day. So I went to a music festival, and I put it out on social media just in case somebody would spot it, because it's such an unusual trike, right? And the next day, they found it just right there where the bike path starts, you know, behind near the bus station, thrown in some bushes, and people had taken off. They broke the seat. They'd taken the basket and the lights and the reflectors. They were, I guess, preparing to strip it. They didn't know that it had a motor, so that was still there. And someone had found it and brought it into the station, so I got it back within a day. Which was really very, very, very good. Because, I mean, there's no way you could ride it around Northampton and not be noticed that was my trike. And there were two articles in the paper about it. It was like the community really got behind me getting my trike back, which I really appreciated.
That's cool. That's cool. So your novel, The Fat Girl Dances with Rocks.
Yeah.
So I read that this summer when I was laid up for a few days, and it belonged to one of my housemates. It was on our bookshelf, and I'm like, oh, here's a book by a local author. I should totally read this. A local author who I know. I really enjoyed it. What would you say this novel is about, or should I say what
I
think?
I want
about?
You to say what you think if you're up for it.
Yeah. So what I remember, so I would say it's like a coming of age story of a young woman, Char. She's 17, lives in suburbia, does a lot of driving around and singing the songs of the 70s of the times with her best friend Felice. And it's kind of about, a little bit about their friendship and Char, like, definitely loves Felice, and they're like their best buds. And Felice, you can't really tell, like, how is she approaching this friendship relationship? It's a lot of just about trying to figure out, like, who, like any coming-of-age story, like, who am I in the world and how do I relate to people? There's also, there's themes of that love between girls and also themes of being a large girl and coming to terms with who you are in the world and how the world is going to accept you or not, and just being proud of your loving yourself for who you are too. So those are some of the things I got out of it.
Yeah, that's it. And I mean, for sure, it's also, it's a coming of age story. Absolutely. That's definitely what it is. But it's also a coming out story, you know, because there's her relationship with her body, and that includes her sexuality too. Mm. And then what that means in relationship with Felice is very confusing.
Yeah, because Felice is like trim and athletic.
Yeah. And she's also, it's just hard to tell whether she's attracted to Char or not. Mm-hmm. Char can't tell. So, and I think that that's kind of, I mean, I think that's certainly, you know, this book is set in the 70s, which is when I was in high school. And I think that a lot of that stuff just went on in really ambivalent fashion for a really long time. Uh-huh. You know, I think that it's not common if you're in your teens to not really be sure, that it is common to not really be sure. You know, sort of putting aside your sexual orientation, like who's attracted to you and who's not, and what does it mean, you know, I mean, and what are you going to do about it? You know, like all those questions are pretty fraught. So that's one of the things I'm exploring here.
Yeah, when just reading it and the different interactions between Felice and Char, and when like Char would want this closeness with Felice, and you know, Felice would sometimes spend a quality time with Char, and then sometimes she'd go off and be with some boy, and it kind of reminded me of that, like when you pick the daisy and you're like, she loves me, she loves me not, she loves me, she loves me not. But it was kind of like, it was heartbreaking. It was so heartbreaking at times to, you know, see Char kind of like put herself out there and Felice just couldn't read her.
Yeah.
But it also reminded me of like, there's so many different kinds of friendship and kinds of love, and it's not, you can't just always put it in these categories of like, you know, of this is the person or the type of person that I have this relationship. I mean, there's just so many, I feel like I've got so many different, like in my life, I feel like I have so many different kinds of friendships that make life rich.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was also really important to me, as you mentioned, that Char is fat, because one thing that, I never had until I started writing the books myself. Then now it's different, but I never had books that had fat girls and women as complex, compelling central characters, you know, and who were not only defined by their fatness. It was there, but they could go ahead and have interesting lives, you know, with this as part of who they are. So that was important to me, too. It's one of the reasons I really love the cover, because it was so joyous. And the original version, my publisher sent it back because they made the cover figure too thin.
Can you describe the cover figure for listeners?
Sure. It's a fat nude. She's dancing. It's a painting. And then the title has sort of, like kind of purpley rocks in the background. She's got a rock in each hand, and there's her hair is swinging in the air, and she has this really just kind of serene expression on her face that I always really liked. And so she's just like having this very, it's sort of self-contained, but really unusual to see moment of joy, like in a landscape, in her fat body.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any hesitations in choosing the title and using the term fat girl?
No, I wanted to use the term fat girl because it had been so powerful for me to get to be able to take that word fat, which had been used. I mean, I had been fat my whole life, and it had been used as a sort of shaming thing, an insult. It's something that, like, you know, boys would yell at me on the street, that people would use to wound, and it's as with you know, words like dyke, you know, like to be able to reclaim that and say, yeah, no, right, I'm fat. And if there's intense feelings of stigma or shame around that word, it doesn't come from the quality itself. It's simply a descriptive word. It's like tall or green-eyed. It's fat, you know. And if you're able to do that, you know, then you can talk about yourself. If you don't have a language for your body that's not, like, medicalized or a euphemism, then, uh-huh. you know, it's a really limitation about how you can be in your body.
Uh-huh. That makes me want to ask this question. Do you think it's okay for people who are thin to describe someone as fat, or is that a descriptive term that like fat people are allowed to call themselves fat?
I think it's okay. I think that there's a range of feelings among people who are fat about sure. how they feel about that word.
Yeah.
So I think it's important to sort of be sensitive to the person you're talking to, you know?
Yeah.
But in general, my own feeling is that the more able we are to use the word, the more able we're able to, we are to have open conversations about what it means to be fat in this culture and to sort of tease out the difference between, you know, the physical experience of being fat and the sometimes very limiting attitudes about fatness that are around you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like sometimes people are buff and yeah. not fat. They look fat, but they're just like solid.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, you know, I guess I want to say this because sometimes people hear, our culture is so charged around body size that sometimes they hear me say positive things about fatness and it reads as a criticism of other types of bodies. And I just want to say, no, I'm talking about celebrating every kind of body, you know? I mean, but it has to be, fatness has to be explicitly included or it's assumed to be not worth celebrating.
Mm-hmm. There's a quote I'm going to read from your book. Oh, by the way, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring, and I'm here with Susan Stinson, a local author. This show was originally recorded on August 17th, 2016. We're talking about her book, Fat Girl Dances with Rocks, published in 1994, but recently read by me. So there's a quote here about, so when the main character, Char, is going swimming with her mom, I'm just going to read a few sentences here. In the locker room. Wait, should I let you read this?
No, you read
okay.
it.
In the locker room, Mom and I were like two dark balloons at a skinny girl's parade. They watched us with covert looks, suspicious of themselves, suspicious that some part of our bodies might suggest some part of theirs. That quote, it resonated with me because I was like, I've done that. Yes. I've looked at someone, a large person, and been like, oh, I don't like that part of myself that resembles that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, yeah. And I think, I mean, people of all genders have different ways of relating to fatness. But I think that I've certainly experienced as a part of sexism that, you know, women are encouraged, you know, you sort of rank each other. There's this hierarchy of the body. And if you're thinking that your primary value is how you look, you know, then that gets an extra pressure put on it. It becomes more and more important, you know.
Yeah, reading this book also made me think a little bit about my high school years. And it recalls, I was thinking about one particular time, like just reading about Char and her struggles and coming out. I remember this one particular time when I was like a junior, senior in high school. Well, I was her age. And I was always really athletic and played basketball. And I was shooting around on the basketball court outside in the park with boys. And some of the boys were like, you're a lesbian, aren't you? And I said, no, that's disgusting. And I was just like, and then that's one of the things I'm regretful about in my life, that I had no, I don't know, it's like I had no eyes to see at that time in my life, like what life was like for others. This was like in the Bible Belt and very conservative and, you know, just very little exposure. And I just feel sad that I feel like I had so little, I wish I'd had more openness at that time for friends of mine that like were on the basketball team with me, and that I just, I don't know.
Well, it's one of the ways that stuff works. I mean, you know, there's a poem that I'm not going to read because it uses language that you can't use on the radio, but I love to read it because it takes all those things that we get accused of, right? The sort of things that have been yelled at me on the street all my life. And it kind of traces their power back to the power and beauty of the body, which I think it comes from in the first place. And it's sort of, I think it's the way that the sort of social, it's a form of social control. You know, if you can accuse somebody of being fat, if you accuse somebody of being a lesbian, and, you know, if somebody accused you of being a lesbian at this point, you know, you would probably have a really different perspective on that,
totally.
Wouldn't you? Yeah. So, you know, if that stuff doesn't frighten you, then it won't keep you in line, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So it's one of the reasons that sort of being able to look right at fat and fatness and see how it's used to keep so many of us in line, because it really is, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things, Venus of Chalk is my third book, and my second book, Martha Moody, is like just a love song to fat women. It's a love affair between two fat women, and it's set in the West, but I was taking a swim class with fat women in Boston. This is in the early 80s, and so I was seeing all these other fat bodies in the locker room for the first time, mm-hmm. and I was having this kind of like aesthetic, emotional, political, physical, like, explosion of possibility. And so my second book came out of that. But Venus of Chalk, while I was reading, so Fat Girl Dancing with Rocks came out in, I think, 94, and then 95 was Martha Moody, and the year 93 was my poems and short essays, Belly Songs in Celebration, about fat women. So they all centered on the lives of fat women, and it was one after another for 3 years. And so while I was traveling with those books and I was reading from them, all these people were coming up to me, mostly women, but of all different sizes, and they were whispering to me like their stories about like pain around their relationships with their bodies. Mm-hmm. And they would ask me how I came to have a good relationship with my own body, because they could see that I did. And so Venus of Chalk starts with a woman who is, she's fat, she's middle-aged, and she gets harassed on the street, and she self-harms. She holds the match to her arm. Because I wanted to start with somebody who is in like a really serious moment of pain and then move through it. Because there's no magic way to do it. It's slow, and I always think it took grassroots politics and great artists to help me, like, even find my belly and tell that it was soft mm-hmm. and pleasurable to the touch, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is there any poem from Belly Songs that you might be interested in reading?
Oh, Belly Songs, sure. See, the one I had marked is not the one I'm going to read.
Well, I can just mention that this is out there on Valley Free Radio. I'm Ruthie Woodring, and we're talking with Susan Stinson, local author and cyclist and writing coach, editor, etc.
Yeah, you know, I used to, I was the writer in residence at Forbes Library for 5 years, and I still run a writing room there. So I was so happy to hear the public service announcement for Forbes before we started. Okay, I'm going to take just a section from a lyric essay. So I'm going to start in the middle here, and it's a woman looking at her belly. She's laying on the bed and she's looking at her belly and she's thinking about it. She says, "I consider my belly. It's pale. I fasted. It's loose. I never ate dinner. It's under hairs. I went to the hospital every week. It swells out, then folds. They said my body was made of cubes of butter. It shakes, it moves, it jiggles. They said each quarter pound I lost was like cutting a cube of butter off a big block. I take my belly in my hands. It's warm. My fingers feel cool, but quickly warm too. It has a good weight, is soft. I sit very still and feel the pulse in my thumbs, then find the pulse in the place of my thickest fat. It's delicate and regular. There, yes, there, yes, there. It comes from the undersides where my palms are resting, from the left half and the right half, from veins that curve out with the rest of me. This is not dead lard. It's my body. It's my living fat.
Thanks. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah. So this book, Belly Songs, is a Northampton product. It came out of a small press that called Orogeny Press. It's the name of one of the pieces of in the book, Mountain Building Episodes. It's a geological term. Uh-huh. And one of the essays is structured like the sections of a geological map. My dad was a geologist.
Hence some of the rocks in Fat Girl
Dances
with Rocks.
Yeah, right, right. But we were all in the Valley Lesbian Writers Group. The other members of the press were Janet Alves, who was the poet laureate in New Hampshire for a while, and Sally Belrose, who's a wonderful local writer. And we published a chapbook by each of us, and we did like local fundraising to pay for it. So this is a very Northampton based book.
I'm going to go back to a few other things in Fat Girl Dances with Rocks. Another thing, when I was reading it, there's often meal times at Char, the main character's house, and so Char's mom and herself are fat, and her brother and her dad are skinny. And it's like the brother and dad eat whatever they want, and Char and the mom are just, it's always about the diet, always about the diet.
Yeah. Earlier, before we got on the air, you were talking to me about what's autobiographical and what's not in a book, and I was saying that that's a little hard to answer. But that particular thing is autobiographical in my own life. And I was put on a diet when I was in the fifth grade, and my mother and my sister went on it. And my dad, who was fat too, he didn't do it, but it came from a doctor that my mother would, make dinner for my brothers and my dad, and they would eat. And we didn't eat. Like, my sister and I had school lunch. That was our last meal. And then, so, the cooking, having the boys and the men, my dad eating, and then we'd had smaller portions of their leftovers for breakfast the next day.
Were you hungry a lot?
Well, yeah. And you also, that's pretty gendered, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You ate your brother's and your dad's leftovers for breakfast the next day.
Mm-hmm. And again, that was from a medical doctor. My mom didn't make that up. That was a prescribed way to diet.
It seems like it would be kind of hard to be free and loving food, even in healthy portions or at any time.
So dieting, I have a strong critique of dieting, and I also have a big respect for people's own bodily autonomy. So whatever choices you make, I'm assuming you're making the best choices for you at that moment. Do you know what I mean? That's, it feels important to say, because there's so much judgment around how we eat. And so I try not to participate in that. Yeah. But I always had pleasure in food. I always did,
I love eating. Yes, I do.
Well, I saw you at the farmer's market, and you gave me this beautiful, you had a split watermelon, and you were just like, do you want some? And you cracked it open.
It was already cracked.
I know, so it's split right back. And just like having me a beautiful hunk of this dripping sweetness and that. And then you gave it to a couple other people. It was like, that was like such a great model of like, pleasure in eating,
Now I want to talk about another thing at Fat Girl Dances with Rocks, which is the driving part. So in terms of what's autobiographical or not, so the main character Char, like she and her friend Felice, they just love to drive. They love to drive, turn up the radio. Oh yeah, we're gonna have to stop for a song soon. I'm gonna play a song, and then we'll come back to the driving part. It's time for a break. This is some Helen Reddy.
Delta Dawn, what's that flower you have on? Could it be a faded rose from days gone by? And did I hear you say he wasn't meeting you here today to take you to his mansion in the sky? She's 41 and her daddy still calls her baby.
That song brings you back to somewhere, doesn't it?
Well, you know, yeah, you've got to know that that song, yeah, I haven't heard it in a really long song. It's in the book, you know, it's in the book while they drive around and they sing it at the top of their lungs. And yeah, that is so autobiographical. We would go to downtown Denver and we'd drive up and down a particular street, you know. So we were in the suburbs. You go to downtown, you're like being really brave if you were us, or at least you thought you were, and and the way that that chorus just repeats and goes on and on, and we would do it in these, I mean, I was born in Texas, but we would do it in southern accents that really weren't right, and that soft part, you know, how they do the chorus really soft for a minute there, all of that is very, I just really, yes, I felt like I was back in the Vega with Delta Dawn. And Helen Reddy sang it, and she also did I Am Woman, so, you know, she had a certain little charge in that way, too. Yeah.
Yeah. So how did you go from just, you know, loving to drive around the streets of in suburbs of Denver to becoming a human-powered vehicle operator?
Well, okay, so the truth is I never really loved to drive. I like to be driven. So, I mean, I would drive, but I never really loved it. It was different in the West. I mean, one of the things that I really love about Northampton is that it was laid out before cars.
Yes.
So it's on such a human scale
yes.
that you really can get anywhere you need to get on a bike like they used to do on foot and horses and wagons, you know?
Yes.
So, but in suburban Denver, you would have to work a lot harder to even get like to the mall, you know? So, so driving was definitely built into the plan. And, yeah, my family was from Texas, and my dad, when he was young, like used to stand beside the road. He didn't have a car. He was one of, I'm forgetting, eight kids, a big family. And but for a few years, like before the war, he knew every single make and model, because any car that would go by, he'd be figuring out what it was, you know. So cars, I mean, I'm from a family of people who love to drive. My brother is a landscape artist, and feels like I gave up one of the basic pleasures of life when I stopped driving. Right. But, and you know, right, there's lots of ways in which it's pleasurable, but costs so much money, costs so much to the planet. And I wanted to keep moving, you know, so there's, and I also wanted to be outside in the world, you know. So, and as I said, my partner helped me find the right bike for me. And before I had a bike, a trike, I walked everywhere. But then I started developing arthritis, and I was getting really constrained with my walking. And so that's one of the reasons, spider in a tree, I was riding a lot in the cemetery across from my house, because I could get, there was a beautiful green place. And then I started reading the gravestones, and I got interested in the story. So, it's one of those things about, if you're walking or you're biking or triking, you have a different relationship to the landscape, you know? I mean, you really, and because you're going slower, you or might be more likely to stop and spend 25 cents and have a great cup of lemonade and an inspiring conversation, et cetera, you know?
Oh, yeah. So was there any, what time frame in your life did you kind of transition from,
from cars,
being driven to,
and driving, because I did drive. Well, when I moved, so I grew up in the West, and then when I moved east, I didn't have a car. I lived in Boston, so I was living in a city for the first time ever, and you know, there was great public transportation, but my parents, my dad was retiring, they were moving to Texas, and they brought me a Thunderbird small car. So I had like a really big car for a little while, which, you know, I had a hard time parking in, but it did, I mean, it gave me certain, so time period, when was that? I guess when I moved to, I lived in the hill towns for a while, and that was someplace else where I was using that car to get to work and stuff. But I got in an accident. It got totaled, and I was like, "Okay, that's it," you know. So, and I think that was in the '90s, early '90s. Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. So, I haven't had a car for a really long time.
I think I'm going to play a couple more things here. You know, since we're talking about the car-free stuff, I always got to play the Bike Lab PSA. This Saturday and every Saturday. Oh, and thanks to Chris McCauley for covering Bike Lab last week. And I think Chris is going to be there again this week.
I found a bike today. It looks so good. Why did you throw it away?
You want to learn to fix your bike? How to keep it tuned up so it's there for you when you need it? Or maybe you know already, but you just need to borrow a bike-specific tool that you don't have. Well, come to the Bike Lab.
Almost every Saturday since 2004, from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m., here in Northampton at 12 Northern Avenue.
Come with your bike or your questions.
And your willing attitude.
Spare parts scavenger hunt every weekend.
Venga para el Bike Lab de Northampton y se divertirá mucho, le enseñará muchas lecciones como arreglar bicicletas.
All repairs guaranteed to the end of the driveway.
Details are online at pedalpeople.coop. That's the Saturday Bike Lab at 12 Northern Avenue,
11 a.m. to 2 p.m.
They say freedom isn't free, but at the Bike Lab it is.
Ya súbase a la bici, compa. Trépese a la de montaña, la bici urbana, la bici cross. Lléguele a la bicicleta. Ya de menos a la eléctrica o a la estática, ya no hay tos. Llegaré pedaleando en
el viaje de allá pa' acá.
Can I ask you a question about the bike lab?
Yeah.
So I've wondered two things. One is that I really, well, like if a person showed up with a trike, is that okay?
Sure. People show up with all kinds of wheel contraptions. I've had someone show up with like a Razor scooter and be like, oh, what's going on with these bearings? Or I can't get this to fold up right. So any kind of mechanical questions you have with wheel contraptions. And, you know, if we can help you think through something, we will.
Yeah. So, and it's okay if you're not very mechanically inclined
definitely.
Yourself.
Yeah. You know, one of my favorite stories of someone coming who wasn't mechanically inclined was this guy came walking into the bike lab in the backyard. He had his bike minus the front wheel in one hand, and he had the front wheel in the other hand. And he walked up. He was like so flustered. He said, I was just riding down the street. I was riding down Woodmont. This is back before they repaved Woodmont, and it was really, really bumpy. He said, I was riding down the street, and I hit the bump, and like my whole bike fell apart, and I don't know what to do. So people of all skill levels, like some people come and they like,
did you get his bike back? Did you help him?
Yeah, we happened to put his front wheel back on. He was like, oh, that's all it is? Oh, that's great.
Love that happy ending.
Yeah. And then some people come and they have, you know, a complicated problem and like, is my frame out of alignment? Maybe anything we can do to fix it? Do you think it's safe? Sometimes people know exactly what they need to do. They need to repack their bottom bracket. They just need to borrow the bike specific tools. Some people don't want to do anything on their bike. They just want to come and hang out. So, and some people are like, they come because they want to help someone else learn about their bike. But it's mostly a learning space. I is the goal.
Well, because my seat has been a little loose ever since I stole it. It came back broken, and so I need to order a new one and get it replaced, but I'm a little intimidated. So maybe I'd do that and haul it over there and do it in the company of others.
Yeah. You should come. It's fun to think through things together and how to fix them and all that. I'm trying to think, Susan, if I have... Oh, yeah, did I say you're listening to Out There? This is... Susan Stinson and I have been talking. Susan is a local author who lives in Northampton, who's written a few books, Fat Girl Dances with Rocks, Spider in a Tree. Do you want to say anything more about Spider in a Tree? That's your most recent book,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and it was published by Small Beer Press, which is an amazing local press. And my editor at Small Beer, Kelly Link, one of her short stories just got picked for All Boston Reads. They're all going to read one of her stories, which is so exciting. The Fairy Handbag is a great story. So it's set in the 18th century in Northampton during the time of the preacher, theologian, and slave owner Jonathan Edwards. And so the fact that he's a slave owner kind of becomes central to the book.
Mm-hmm. You said you sat in the Bridge Street Cemetery while you were writing parts of this?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I wrote it all over Northampton. It was one of the reasons it was so great to be out on a trike. I would just ride to different spots and think of, okay, I'd watch what people were doing now and sort of translate in my head to what they would have been doing at this spot at this moment in the 18th century. It was, and every time an insect showed up, which happened a lot, I stopped everything and wrote what they were doing, because I started to realize that, no pesticides, there wouldn't even wire screens, there'd be insects everywhere. Mm-hmm. So I started to think of them as sort of like ambassadors from the past. Mm-hmm. And insects are doing some pretty interesting things.
Yeah. This is kind of off topic, but I wonder if I can share an insect story from last week.
Yeah.
So I'm a trash hauler, and in the trash business, maggots are a common find. The maggot index has been really high lately with the temperature and the humidity and all that.
Yeah.
And last week I was picking up customer's trash. The customer is actually right there changing the windshield wipers on their car. And the trash that we pick up is usually bagged in the barrel. So like I pulled off the first bag and put it on the trailer. And then underneath that bag, the other half of the barrel was just full of ripped up trash. The animals had gotten into it. It had rainwater in it. And it was like all soggy, and there were diapers and stuff in there, and a big pile of maggots. So
was it 90 degrees?
Yeah, it was like 90 or some degrees. Oh, yeah. And so I took the garbage can and I just flipped the whole thing upside down on the, because I didn't want to just put it into a bag. I had an extra bag, but I didn't want to put all the water into a bag, too. So I just flipped the garbage can upside down on the ground. And it was like a permeable surface. It was like kind of gravelly surface. So I'm like, okay, I'll just flip the can upside down, let the water drain, and then take a bag and sort of grab it from the top and try and flip it all over into the bag. And so I did that, more or less. But then, so I got all the trash in my bag and put the bag of trash on the trailer. But then what was left was a little carpet of maggots. And I knew from past experience that the ants would come along real quick. And so I just squatted there and watched. And at first, I was like, you know, in the first, like, 20 seconds, there's only, like, a couple of ants. And within, like, a minute, there's, like, a dozen, like, five ants. And I was telling the customers there, I was like, wow, there's a lot of maggots here. There's going to be an ant battle, an ant-maggot battle coming up real soon. And then you see the ants come, and they would, like, one ant would come and latch on to a little maggot, like, bite it and latch onto it. And the maggot would writhe and spin and try and knock the ant off. And the ant would just, like, ride it like a bucking bronc. And then, like, another ant would come and join, and two of them would be on the same maggot. And you just, it's such a fascinating, fascinating thing. And I think there were a lot of well-fed, happy ants that night.
That is the best insect story I've ever heard.
Anyway, yeah, I discovered the ant maggot situation once when I was emptying Florence downtown trash, and there was nowhere for me to put the maggots except right on the asphalt. And I was like, oh, these poor maggots, they're going to fry on the black asphalt on this 90-degree day. But I came back like half an hour later where I had flipped over the can, and there was a pile of ants where there had been a pile of maggots. There was like live, excited ants.
And that, see, was what I was like. I didn't know. This is public information. I had no idea there was a relationship between ants and their food and maggots. Didn't know.
Anyway, very fascinating. It's coming up on 5 o'clock. At 5 o'clock, Democracy Now! Will be on. And I think I'm going to save time for another song that we'll go out with. But I want to ask you, Susan. Well, you know what? Is there anything that you want to say about your books, where you can get your books?
Yeah.
And your website? And
what? Yeah, yeah. So all of my books are at Forbes Library, which is so great. And so if anybody's interested in any of them, you can check them out and read them at Forbes. Broadside carries my books. They always have Spider and Tree for sure. And they sold out of Martha Moody, but I'm going to bring some in pretty soon. And if you're interested in any of the other, ask them, because some of them are out of print, but I've got used copies, and maybe we could work some out where they would carry them. So, and I, you know, supporting local businesses is always nice. So that's a great place to get them.
Cool. And I have a copy of Fat Girl Dances with Rocks. You can get it from the 8 High Street Lending Library too. And also, like, you can go on your website, susanstinson.net, and get information.
Right.
All right. So since we have time, I want to say one more thing about Fat Girl Dances with Rocks. Another thing in the book that struck me was towards the second half of the book, the main character, Char, and her friend Felice, they're split up because Felice goes away for a summer job. And Char works at a nursing home and just learns so much, like the wisdom of the elders at this nursing home with older people. And I guess it's for disabled people as well as older people. I had two questions about that. One is, when she works at the nursing home, there are so many characters. It's like 10 different names and characters, and I couldn't keep track of who was who. How come there's so many names and characters in that section?
Well, I think that might reflect the fact that it is my first book. And I was, again, you know, I had worked at a nursing home in the summer when I was in high school. So I was drawing on my direct experiences. And one of the things that was so striking to me, I mean, I was young then, I was in high school, but that there are all these people here, you know, and they sort of, their lives don't get acknowledged that much, but they knew so much. Yeah. And really right now, as I mentioned, I have arthritis in my knees, and I'm feeling so grateful, especially for the things I've learned from disabled people in my life, you know, that there's just all sorts of wisdom in our communities that we kind of, if we neglect it, we do that to our great loss, you know, as individuals and as a group.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm going to wrap it up and play Olivia Newton-John. Any last words before we
Oh, so Olivia Newton-John, this is the context from the Fecker Dance with This Rocks. Char and her friend Felice are dancing to this song, yeah, at the very beginning of the book. So I'm going to have another nostalgia. Thank you. Thank you for letting me visit this book again and the music of this book. It's been such a pleasure.
Thank you so much for coming on the show.